listen to these words, God's words, from the book of Joshua. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people into the land that I swore to their ancestors that I would give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey the law that I gave to my servant Moses. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you can be careful to do everything that is written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord, your God, will be with you wherever you go. The word of the Lord.
Well, good morning again, everybody. And I'm just really, really thrilled to introduce a very good friend of mine today. This is Drew Hyun. And he's such a good friend that for over a year I was pronouncing his last name wrong, and he never corrected me. Never once did he correct me. That's called friendship.
Grace.
Right? Drew is a church planter here in the city. He's the leader of the Hope Church Network, which is an amazing group of 9 churches that are all thriving. They have a very unique set of DNA that make them successful. And when I was thinking about Drew and the friendship that we developed, I knew he would be the perfect person to share what it means to live life passionately. And so I asked him to come and share today. But let me give you a little bit of background before we get into that. Right after I assumed the role of the interim lead pastor, which was sort of a sudden transition for me. Within that first week, I received a phone call from Drew. And Drew said, James, you're going to have a lot of challenges in the coming year, and probably some high highs and some low lows. You're going to be experiencing a lot of new things, and I really want to be there for you. And so would you like to meet for coffee? And I said, sure. Now, I had known Drew for a few years, kind of passing in similar circles. But after that first time meeting for coffee, I knew right away that the two of us would be fast friends. There's just something about his character, his passion, his vision that makes you want to be close to Drew. And so I have a few questions for you today, Drew.
Wow.
And just to set us up for today. To begin with, I know that for years you were the associate pastor over at New Life Fellowship with Pete Scazzaro.
Mm-hmm.
And there came a time when Pete decided that it was time for him to transition out and to bring in the obvious choice, right? And so he called you up, and the plan was to install you into that role. But a couple weeks before that happened, the Lord started doing something in your heart. Can you share what that looked like and how that transpired?
Yeah. Thanks, James. And thanks for the introduction. It's such an honor to be here and really an honor to be your friend, really. So my story is I was actually a pastor over in Queens for about 10 years at a church called New Life Fellowship, which is in Elmhurst, New York. And Pete Scazzaro, like James mentioned, was a founding pastor. And over the course of a few years, we had been talking about a succession process. And really the plan was for myself, at that point I had grown within the organization, or the church organization, after 10 years to become the senior associate pastor, teaching pastor. And myself, as well as a good buddy of mine named Rich Velotis, who's now the lead pastor, we're basically poised to take over the church as Pete was going to focus on some other endeavors. And so the year prior to that, though, in 2010, I had gone through a pretty significant season of depression. And that was due to a number of different reasons. And kind of when I'd be meeting with spiritual directors and counselors about that whole journey and about this whole prospect of becoming the next lead pastor at this church, along with Rich and us leading into the future, I realized that two things were really keeping me there. The first was every time I thought about leaving, I thought, where am I going to get a better opportunity than this? And, you know, I thought, I don't want to be a nobody. I want to be a somebody. And so I realized one of the things that was keeping me there was prestige. Like, I really liked the idea of having this title, you know? And the second thing that would constantly haunt me is every time I thought about, like, well, if I don't do this, what would I do? I kept worrying deeply about money. And I remember one time waking my wife up in the middle of the night and just saying, like, you know, if you had a more lucrative job, like, I wouldn't be stuck here. And then she slapped me. No, I'm just kidding. But I just remember her just being, she's like, oh. And I remember immediately, and this was like in the middle of the night, she challenges me. She's like, is that who you believe that God is? That God is so small that somehow money is like this big hindrance for what he might do in New Life's life and in your life. And then she went back to sleep. And then I stayed up and stewed over it. But I realized that prestige and financial security were the things that were keeping me there. And so when those things finally came to my consciousness, I remember telling Pete and the elders that these are really awful reasons to be a pastor. You know, prestige and financial security. And so I ended up, at that point, I ended up submitting my resignation, which was a big surprise to Pete as well as the leaders. But I really felt like God, just to live out of integrity, I needed to make this move. And so that's what ended up happening. And yeah, and then led me through a season of the desert, which eventually led me to being where I am today. So, yeah.
I remember you telling me that, you know, Pete, you know, was very gracious. He understood that the Holy Spirit was certainly moving in your life. But that didn't keep him from wanting to reach across the table and strangle you right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
But so you go through this desert experience, and in that desert experience, the Lord started putting some things on your heart, sort of a holy discontent,
yeah.
That where he wanted to lead you. Can you tell me what that ended up looking like for you?
Yeah, I think the thing that God needed to do in me during that season was, so after I left New Life, I subsequently went through a darker season of depression, and it was brutal. And looking back, I realized what God needed to do in me was really stamp out all of those kind of the moments of ego that continually kind of was the residue of why I was doing ministry in the first place. And it really brought me to a point of really this gut check moment. Do I really believe the gospel? Do I really believe that my worth, my security is not found in my position or in being a pastor at this church, but really being a son who's loved by God through Jesus Christ? And so I needed that season. And there's that phrase, you don't know Jesus is all you need until Jesus is all you have. Have you heard that phrase before? And it was one of those moments where I felt like, God, this is it. I need you. And so I think that was the first thing. And then the second thing was, as I was wrestling with church and what do I love and believe about church, you know, there were things about kind of church culture. You know, there's usually great things, and there's also this shadow side. And I realized that in a lot of church cultures, especially in the West, they're often marked by, I remember reading this blog post by this guy named Mike Breen. He talks about how they're marked by a celebrity culture, a consumer culture, as well as a competitive culture. And as I was reading about those things, I realized, man, I really, as much as I love the North American church and want to be part of what God is doing, May whatever I turn to not be marked by those things. And so that's when kind of the seeds of a vision of like, you know, if I were to be part of a church or to start a church, it would really look like if we started a church, we would love so deeply to be part of growing and expanding and reaching out. But once it got to a certain size, because we believe that discipleship and mission are really fundamental to kind of the church's goal, like what if we were to just start new churches in different neighborhoods throughout the city and through that become networked as friends who really, in this non-competitive way, we really kind of were for each other, and we were part of empowering a group of people to go and be sent into the city and into the world to be part of God's mission. So that was kind of the seeds of what happened.
So you jump in.
Yep.
And you start planting churches. And clearly this is something that God is wanting to do in you, because in 5 years you have 9 thriving churches, all with strong leadership, doing great things for the kingdom. They're all growing. The people are really passionate about you. And one of the things that you need to know about Drew is he's one of the most humble guys I know. Even in his own network of churches, when he shows up sometimes, a lot of the people in the congregation don't even know who he is. And he kind of wants it that way, because he likes to do things behind the scenes. He doesn't want the center of attention. He just really wants the spotlight to be on the Holy Spirit and what the Holy Spirit is doing and how the Holy Spirit is moving. And so he's kind of pushing things along from behind the scenes, and the Lord is really blessing that. And so when I started hearing about this, I thought, wow, I have so much to learn from Drew, and there is so much in what he's sharing that I think would be beneficial to Trinity. You know, I need to take some notes. So I started taking notes, and we started meeting regularly, and we really want to collaborate on some great things going forward. We have this a lot of ideas that we'd like to do together. But tell me a little bit about the model of church planting that you've developed, because here's the thing. The model that he has instilled has become so successful that on the national scene, church planting has become sort of almost like a business. You know, I mean, people are really into it right now. There's workshops, there's conferences, there's all sorts of things. And because of what Drew is doing, and because it's so unique, Drew has become nationally recognized as a speaker in those circles because he's doing something somewhat countercultural to what everyone else is doing. And I want you to share a little bit about the values that you have instilled and what you hope to develop in the people that are part of your mission.
Yeah, you're one of the most humble guys I know, so maybe we can have a who's more humble. We can take a vote. That'd be really awkward, but yeah, no, so for us, it feels very organic. What we simply do is we try to be the church that lives into our call and mission, and we really try to get behind people. So it's not like we have this strategic map up over like, oh, where are we going to start a new church? It's more so, where do we see the Spirit working in our midst? And how can we do whatever we can to get behind what the Spirit is doing and then empower them fully? And so of the 9 churches, and we're planting a 10th one this fall, of those churches, like, I haven't visited 5 of them even. I've spent a lot of time with the leaders, but I haven't even been to 5 of them. That's why they wouldn't even know who I am, because I've never showed up. And because we believe that, hey, my role is really to empower and to serve. And so what marks us as a family of churches, what we talked about in terms of our values, at least the top 3 values for us is humility, which is marked by our leading out of brokenness, as well as friendship. So we want to be friends on the journey together, not in this competitive way, but we realize, like, we're part of the same team. And so if we're doing that, then we should be functioning as part of the same team. And thirdly, diversity, that we want to be diverse in terms of our expressions of church. We realize that this city is so diverse in so many different ways. And one of the ways that we can really serve our neighbors and our neighborhoods is by really embodying the same type of diversity. And so we hope that this is what marks us in many ways. We've got other values as well, but those I would say are the top ones that we're constantly talking about as pastors and leaders and in the people that we're pastoring and shepherding.
And one of the things that you need to know about Drew as well is that he's so incredibly generous with his time and his energy and so collaborative. One of the things that I think is really important as leaders in the city is to work closely with other ministries, to come alongside, to add value where you can, to share resources. I think that's what God would want us to do. And so I'm constantly sending out emails and making phone calls to different pastors around the city to see if we could do some things together. And for some pastors, that's a challenge because they have their own agenda, they have a lot of things going, and time, you know, is difficult. There's very little margin. But Drew always responds. Immediately he responds, and he says, yes, let's do this together. And so we've been able to do a number of things together. And in fact, that church plant that is going to be starting up this fall is actually going to be meeting here at Trinity. It's going to be an evening service here at Trinity. So we're going to be, you know, partnering in, you know, we're sharing our space. And I'm really excited about that because I think we can learn a lot from you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Last but not least, I know you have a sermon to preach.
Yeah.
I don't want to take
yeah.
all of our time. But what I do want to ask you is this. We as a congregation right now are talking about what it looks like to live passionately, mm-hmm. to live a life with no regrets. And you are a person that strikes me as someone who, you got this. You understand what that looks like. And so tell me the secret. Tell us the secret of living passionately. You live it. What would that look like for you and the culture that you're trying to instill within the Hope Church network?
Yeah, wow. I don't know. Obviously, there is no silver bullet for that. I do know that the Christian life is marked by a life where we recognize that life is not about us. It's not about me, and it's not about my agenda. It's about God and what he's doing. And so I know that oftentimes I get so caught up in my own agenda, my own thoughts, my own kind of difficulties that I navigate through, that I would say, you know, the marker for me to continually to move forward and to continue to press forward into God and his call and his destiny is to recognize, is to just get off of my agenda and to realize that life is not about me. And so when I can do that, then slowly, hopefully, some of the things dissipate and I can, you know, I don't get it right all the time, unfortunately. In fact, very little. But that's why we need God's grace, so that we can be empowered to live passionately in our marriages, as single people, in our workplaces, and so on and so forth. So I would say that when we can die to ourselves daily and live fully for God, that's when we can begin to live passionately.
Thank you, Drew. Isn't he a gift? Man, I just love this guy. And now you get the benefit of hearing him preach. So it's an added bonus for all of you and for me. As a pastor, I don't get to hear a lot of other people preaching live because I'm usually tied up somewhere. But today I get to sit here and listen to one of my best friends really get into Joshua and talk with us about what it really means to live passionately. So, Drew, I'll let you take it
away. Thanks.
Thanks,
James.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, man. Should I stay on this platform here, or can I walk down there as well?
Wherever you feel most comfortable.
All right, fantastic. Thanks, James. Oh, I should probably help you with that, but hey, it is such an honor, and what, something that James didn't mention, so this whole idea of generosity, our Midtown Church, which is the church that I lead now, which is just 9 blocks from here, when we were first getting started in the summer of 2014, we actually held our launch team gatherings with about 20 of us right here in the basement of Trinity Baptist, and so Trinity has actually been part of our story, and so you all are part of our story and the generosity that you have shown us, and so in many ways, I feel like I'm simply riding the wave of what God is doing through churches with a legacy just like Trinity. In fact, I don't know if my video made it in the 150-year-old celebration or anniversary, but I actually submitted a video just thanking so deeply your congregation for the ways that you've invested in us. Because again, we do feel like we're beneficiaries of what God has done. So if you're new here or visiting, or if you're not a Christian, I just want to say welcome. We're so glad you're here at Trinity. And I want you to know that I'm actually a guest. So if what you don't hear today doesn't kind of sit well with you, I'm not the regular here. So you should come back next week and come and hear and see kind of who's the regular communicator right here at Trinity. James has started this sermon series on 1 month to live, and really with this idea of what does it mean for us to live kind of this life of urgency and importance and of significance. And he's tasked me with this task of talking about what does it mean to live passionately. And of course, there's this passage from Joshua chapter 1, which was read for us earlier. And Joshua chapter 1 is this passage where it's kind of the precipice of a pivotal moment in the history of Israel. It's this moment where basically Moses has died. Moses, who's this patriarch, and even if you're not a Christian here, you've probably heard the name Moses or heard of the amazing things that Moses has done in leading his people. But there comes this moment where he dies, and his protege named Joshua is now tasked with leading the people that had been freed from captivity from the people of Egypt, are now leading them into what was first promised to them, the promised land. And so here Joshua is, standing on the precipice of what's before him. And the question is, what is he going to do with this? In this moment, what's he going to do? And of course, this title or this idea of living passionately, what we're going to explore is, number one, why is it so difficult many times for us, like it probably would have been for Joshua, to live passionately? And secondly, how do we begin to walk into living passionately? And so why is it so difficult for us? Well, if you notice actually in Joshua chapter 1, this is what it starts with. Joshua chapter 1, verses 1 to 2. It says, after the death of Moses. Now you got to get this context then. There are people, the people of Israel, there are thousands upon thousands that are following Joshua, had followed Moses for many years. Now Moses, of course, was this miracle worker, had led the people of Israel from captivity into freedom. All of these miracles. Can you imagine Moses? Just the enormous kind of charisma and presence he must have had. He's described in the Bible as being the humblest man alive. He's described in the Bible as someone who spoke face to face with God. Can you imagine? Like this shadow, this looming shadow of a figure that Moses is. He led his people. I mean, the people of Israel had witnessed Moses lead them after miracle, freed them from captivity. And here Joshua is. This young understudy who's learning. And here's how it starts in Joshua chapter 1. It basically says, it says this, after the death of Moses, if we can put up that passage again, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Can you turn to your neighbor and say, Moses, my servant, is dead? I mean, like, can you almost just feel the weight of this moment, these words, Moses, my servant, is dead. I mean, can you imagine all the miracles that Joshua must have witnessed Moses do and perform on behalf of the people of God? I mean, I can imagine, like for me, I'm a big sports fan, and when I think about, like, some athletes who are larger than life, like LeBron James is someone that I really, to imagine someone to actually somehow dying, and this is just LeBron James, but can you imagine Moses? Someone who spoke face to face with God. Someone who delivered his people through the Red Sea. Can you imagine this moment? And here Joshua is, and here God is. It's not like God is kind of glossing over things. He doesn't quite say like, hey, I know it's been a big moment, but hey, guess what? I believe in you. He doesn't do that. He actually gives the reality of life in all of its difficulty right then and there to Joshua. And he says to him very clearly, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. It's this moment, this pivotal moment in Joshua's history where he is to make this choice. Do I live with the fullness that God has called me to, with the destiny that he's called me to? Or do I live captive to some of the things that block me from living passionately? You know, as I was thinking about this idea, why is it that so many of us, and I'm included in this list, so often succumb to a life that is dispassionate, that does not live with fervor and urgency and fire? Why is that? And some of the things I recognize, number one, reasons why I often fail to live passionately, number one is fear. Now, Joshua, of course, knows fear very intimately. Because in Numbers chapter 13 to 14, which is again a history of Israel and their kind of journey through the wilderness before they're to enter into the promised land, Moses and the team send a group of people to scout out the promised land to see, like, hey, go passionately take the promised land that God has given to you.
And of the 12 that are sent, Joshua and Caleb are the only ones. They come back and bring the report. And the report basically is like, oh my goodness, the people there, they're so big and they're so strong and there's no way we're going to be able to go there. And here Joshua is and Caleb, and they're like, no, we've got this. We've got the God who parted the Red Sea on our side. And I know for Joshua, perhaps, this was a moment for him where he witnessed the fear that oftentimes cripples us from moving forward. We think about the giants in the land. We think about all of these different things that we fear. We fear what will happen or what might happen or what might not happen. We fear what other people think of us. We fear the worst kinds of outcomes. And I know oftentimes in my own life, I am so saddled with fear at times. I get so anxious because I'm constantly looking at what might happen. All of these things externally. I once heard this one preacher say, he said, you know, the way that we often preach is, God, look at how big my problems are. Look at how big these obstacles are. And he said he's learning to pray. Obstacles, look how big my God is. Look how big my God is. And there are some of us today, perhaps we're just saddled and crippled with fear and anxiety about the future. This doesn't mean that it's sinful to feel this way, but what's sinful, because fears were part of this. Even in the story of Joshua later on, they fear the Amorites, they fear these different people. But time and time again, they're encouraged to not look at how big their problems are, but to look at how big and magnanimous God is. And so fear, I think, is one thing that often cripples me from living passionately. And I imagine it cripples many of us. But not only fear, I think there's also failure. Failure. Some of us, because we've failed at times, we feel like we're covered in shame. And we think, oh man, of course, God can't use me because I've just expired or been disqualified as a leader of his. You know, I'm sure that Joshua knew the story of Moses, who was his mentor, because Moses would write about this. Moses would write about the call of God on his life and how difficult it was, Moses of all people, this incredible figure in the history of Israel, how Moses himself was actually someone who was so sheepish about leading. Why? Because he was a murderer. Why? Because he was unskilled in speech and he stammered. And time again, God would be like, Moses, I'm calling you to free the people of Israel. And Moses would be like, yeah, I got it. You got the wrong guy. You know, and time again, God would have to press in and say, you are not defined by your shame, your weakness, or your failure. In fact, when you go, you can tell them, I am has sent you. You know, some of us, we carry this sense of shame and guilt over mistakes we've made, and we feel like failures. We feel like we've messed up or are beyond kind of what God can do. Some of us feel like, man, I'm too young to be used by God. Some of us feel like, I'm too old to be used by God. What if today was the day that God was to tell you, no, I've got an amazing purpose for your life today. You know, if you're anything like me, though, it's, there's all these kind of this pushback with God, right? Like, well, God, I just don't know. Like, I don't come from a lineage of wealth. Or maybe I do come from a lineage of wealth, and I feel like God can't really use me because, I'm wealthier. If that's you, come talk to me afterwards. We'd love to talk about how you can donate and be part of what's happening here. There's all sorts of ways that we think about this. We are more defined by the shame we carry, by our failures, than we are by God and his call on our lives. His now then, his Moses is dead, but now then you. How many of us today, maybe we've just kind of staggered into church today and our failures continue to haunt us about what God says about you and how he can use you. And the amazing thing about the God that we serve is he's a God of second chances, of third chances, of all of the ways and all of the ways that Moses tries to convince God not to use him. God says, nope, nope, not good enough, not good enough. You can just tell them, I am has sent you, and that will be good enough. How many of us, failure is what keeps us from living passionately? Or thirdly, there's apathy. Some of us fail to live passionately because there's just apathy for things that matter. Instead, we would rather live more into the American dream, or we'd rather live into the kind of the narrative of what New York tells us about what success looks like. And God has placed like a God-given destiny and fire in our hearts, and yet what we do is we continue to succumb to just apathy, to be apathetic towards those things, and we end up living for things that perhaps ultimately aren't worth the things that we thought they were. You know, Francis Chan has this phrase. He says, our biggest fear should not be failure, but it should be succeeding at things that don't really matter. How many of us, one thing that keeps us living passionately for God is we're just apathetic towards God and we're more passionate about other things. You know, the people of Israel, kind of in their wandering in the wilderness, there would come these moments where like, why weren't we back in Egypt? We had better food back then. In other words, what they were saying to Moses and to leaders like Joshua is, we would rather be slaves than live into the freedom and the power that God has for us. We're apathetic towards this call. We would rather live for something else. You know, I do think that these are many of the common reasons why I fail to live passionately. I get too caught up in my fears, my failures, and even my apathy at times. And I would much rather just watch Netflix or something, you know, like anything to get my mind off of living passionately and fully for what God might have for me. What are the ways in which God is calling you? But again, here's the thing about living passionately. It's easy to live passionately when things are going well, when the Mets are winning, which is very rarely, but like that's when it's easy to live passionately. We can be enthralled with that kind of life. See, but the real challenge for many of us is not about, can we live passionately when things are going great and we feel like our stomachs are full and we feel like life is just one smooth ride? The question is, are we able to live passionately in these defining moments where Joshua stands with this choice, do I live passionately into the destiny that God has for me? Or do I succumb to the reality that Moses is dead and there's no way that God can use me? Richard Rohr, who's an author who I greatly admire, he wrote a book called Adam's Return. And Richard Rohr is a Franciscan priest. And in his book, he talks about how the journey for spiritual growth and the kind of heroic life that all of us long for. He writes, as he studies some of these ancient figures, about the five truths that anyone who enters into the deeper journey or the spiritual journey, these five truths must be embraced for all of us so that we can live a passionate or a heroic life. And so I thought it'd be helpful to go through these five things, because what might surprise you is that these five truths are not truths that are like these self-help tips about like, hey, you better learn this and then you can live with fire and passion. But instead, these five truths are the part of the deeper journey that God takes us through that allows us to fully walk into the God-given destiny that he has for us. So here they are. The first truth that Richard Rohr talks about. Number one, life is hard. Can you high-five your neighbor and say, life is hard? Can you do that real quick? Yeah. Some of you are like, I hate this sermon. You love the sermon. Life is hard. That one of the things that we have to realize for any of us who want to live the deeper life, the passionate life, we have to understand that life is hard. It's not just a walk in the park, but that every single one of us will experience these moments, these gut check moments, like Joshua, where we come face to face with the difficulties of life. Life is hard. I mean, isn't it true though? So many of us, we have this kind of grass is greener on the other side mentality. But how many married people know that life is hard? Any married people know that? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about? Only a few of you raised your hands. Sorry if I outed you, but any single people know what I'm talking about? Life is hard. Life is hard, right? I mean, here's the thing. You know, living in a place as diverse as New York, what I've learned is that for everyone, whether it's the banker in finance, whether it's a school teacher or the stay-at-home parent, everyone realizes this. We all recognize that life is hard, especially in New York. I mean, isn't it true? It doesn't matter how much wealth someone has. Certainly there are different degrees of suffering and of, but the reality is every single one of us, and the illusion is that some of us can walk into church and we kind of bring our Sunday best, and the illusion is that somehow that, oh, life is not that hard for that family or that person. It's just me. But you and I know whenever we've had the opportunity to just sit and talk to one another and explore other stories, each one of us, despite what our net worth might be, despite what country we immigrated from or whether we grew up in New York, we all recognize that life is hard. And to live passionately, we don't live with these illusions that somehow life is going to be easy and just one kind of easy cakewalk. Somehow if we move to the Poconos or we move to Florida, life is going to be easier, right? The reality is just life is hard. Number two, not only is life hard, can we go to number two? Your life is not about you. Can you high five your neighbor and say, your life is not about you? High five your other neighbor and say, it's about the kids. No, I'm just kidding. Some of you parents, that hit home right there. Your life is not about you. I mean, but for me, I'm so preoccupied with my life and what people will think. I remember the first time I was asked to stand in a wedding. It was with my oldest brother, Stefan, who all of us were 3.5 years apart. And so this was the first wedding that I was going to stand in. And I remember getting ready. And so my other two brothers were also groomsmen to my oldest brother, as well as a mentor of ours. And so this mentor was maybe about 5 to 10 years older than we were. And so I was in my early 20s, and here I am standing in this wedding feeling like really, really honored. I'm going to stand in a wedding, like this big stuff. And so here I am standing in a wedding, and it's one of the first times I'm wearing a tuxedo, if you guys remember that moment where you don't know where things go, the cufflinks and everything else, and I'm like, but I'm trying to act like I have it all together. And so time and time again, I wear the bow tie, I fix everything, and we're waiting in this waiting room, and there's this nervous energy emanating from me. For me, I'm like, I'm not even the best man. I'm like the third guy in line. But here I am. I'm like, I'm so preoccupied. And I'm just like, I'm constantly going to the mirror and like checking my bow tie. I put my bow tie on. I'm like, you know, just looking some more. And then I'd go and I'd sit down. And finally, the mentor who was also part of our wedding party, he just kind of tapped me on the shoulder. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. He goes, hey, listen. I just want you to know this. Like, no one actually really cares about how you look. What? Like, I mean, it just rocked my world. I was like, what? He goes, honestly, no one's even going to be looking at you. You know, honestly, they're not even going to be looking at Steph and your brother. They're like, they don't even care about they're only going to be looking at the bride. So just chill out, dude. This wedding is not about you. I'll never forget that moment. Just that moment, like this realization, like, this is not about me. So many of us in the life that we live, we need to learn this truth that life is not about you. You know, there's this beautiful moment where John the Baptist, who's a precursor to Jesus, he says, he must increase, I must decrease. He says, I am not the Christ. So many of us today, we act like we are our own saviors. We're our own Christ. And like John the Baptist, we need to learn to say these words, I am not the Christ. He must increase, I must decrease. Life is not about you. Number three, not only is life hard, not only is your life not about you, but you are not in control. High five your neighbor and say, you are not in control. It does not matter how many of the latest gadgets you own, how on top of spreadsheets you might be, hell is, you are not in control. How many parents of teenagers know what I'm talking about? Yeah, this moment we're like, oh, man. And I just wish, right, the human impulse is to want to think that I'm in control, that I have it all together, that I'm the one kind of orchestrating things. And yet, one of the deepest and profound truths that we can live and learn is that you and I are not in control. Are you encouraged yet? Number four, here we go, number four. You are not that important. High five your neighbor and say, you are not that important. Oh, yeah. Some of you liked it a little too much to say that to your neighbor. You are not that important. If we're to live lives of significance, we don't think of ourselves as being bigger than we are, but we realize that we're just human beings. Human beings. We're not that important. Don't say that to your child just yet, all right? But can you imagine how this would, how much it would alleviate some of the pressures that we feel? If we just, oh, I'm not that important. You know, when I was leaving New Life, which James and I were talking about earlier, New Life was this place where I had invested in for 10 years, had this grandiose vision for what God would do in my life. And to be there, and when those dreams began to get squelched, and I felt like God was calling me into something new, even though I had no idea what was happening. I remember after leaving New Life, like just this season of depression would hit me. And every so often, it was so hard because I had invested my life and everything into this church. And so after I left, there was this pang of like longing for, man, I wish I was still there, but no, I know that I'm not supposed to be there. And then after I left, there was a part of me that honestly, I wanted them to suffer without me. You know, and so I just wanted, just because I'm like, you know, I wanted them to, when I submitted my resignation, they were so gracious, but instead I wanted to be like, Drew, we cannot let you leave. Like, can we double your salary or just like do anything we can? And, you know, add a no trade clause into that so that you can just stay here and be part of this. And there wasn't any of that. They're like, wow, you're going to leave. God bless you. And so I remember, so a few months later, you know, I tried my best to stay off of social media just because I didn't want to know what was happening. I felt like I ended well. But there's a part of me that was so curious about how things are going. And so a good friend of mine was one of the elders there. And so, and he still is one of the elders. And I remember meeting up with him maybe like 3 or 4 months later. And we sat down and we were eating lunch together and we're exchanging pleasantries. And honestly, I was dying just to ask him like how things were going. Because I wanted, you know, I wanted to sit down with him. And I was hoping that he would basically say, dude, things are falling apart, man. Like, dude, ever since you left. And so I remember talking to him and I was like, hey, so how are things going at New Life? And I leaned in, and he's like, that's right. Man, you left, gosh, how long did you leave? I was like, oh, yeah, it was maybe, I don't know, maybe like 68 days ago or something, you know? And, but he's like, oh, yeah, you left. I said, yeah, it's amazing. Ever since you left, the church has actually flourished and grown. I remember being like, that's awesome, man. That's awesome. Wow, praise God. I mean, it was, oh. And in some ways, I had to learn the hard way. You know what? Ultimately, I'm not that important. Not that important. Lastly, life is hard. Your life is not about you. You are not in control. You are not that important. And lastly, you are going to die. High five your neighbor and say, you are going to die. You're going to die. You know, here's what Rohr talks about. He says that, again, to live the more significant journey, these are the truths we are to embrace. And one of them is the reality that all of us are going to die one day. It doesn't matter if your name is Moses or Joshua or whoever else. You and I are going to die. And the sooner we can embrace this and not think of ourselves as bigger than we are or more significant than we are or somehow immortal, the quicker we can begin to embrace a life of passion, a life that's bigger than ourselves. You and I are going to die one day. You know what's amazing? Is that I can talk about these five different values and talk about it and say, okay, now embrace these five values and go do it now. Go live lives of passion. But see, there's something unique about the Christian story that's different than simply this moralistic, hey, just live this out and go do it. See, the Christian story is part of a bigger story about God and what he's done. You know what's so interesting? It was Jesus teaches this in Matthew chapter 10. This is what he talks about when we begin to live the most significant life. This is what he says. He says, whoever finds their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Isn't that interesting? When I begin to try to grasp my own life and live with passion on my own kind of terms, that's when I've actually lost it. But when I actually release my life, when I actually submit my life, when I actually acknowledge life is hard, I'm not that important, I'm not in control, life is not about me, and I'm going to, when I actually release my life, that's when I find it. In other words, living passionately, what it means is dying daily. Because I don't begin to live for myself and my own agenda, I live for God and what God is doing in my life and in the world, in the world of my kids, in the world of my workplace. I begin to look and live for God and his agenda. Now, isn't this interesting? So even in Joshua, when God comes and he says, Moses is dead, now then, go and be strong and courageous. Because Joshua, you're a five-tool player. You're someone who's been invested in. You've got all the skills to work through whatever difficulties that you've been facing. He doesn't say that. Notice what God says to Joshua about where his strength and his courage come from. He doesn't say, Joshua, it comes from your skill, your ingenuity, your way to muster up passion just based on the gifts and talents that I've given to you. No, 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 no. He doesn't say this. Check it out. This is what he says. In Joshua chapter 1, he says, be strong and courageous, for I am with you. Never will I leave you or forsake you. Have I not reminded you, be strong and courageous? Not because somehow you're some spiritual all-star, someone that's been anointed by God. And while these things might have been true, he says, no, 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 don't be strong and courageous because of that. Be strong and courageous, for I am with you. Be strong and courageous because never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Now, isn't this the heart of the Christian message? That on my own and my own reserves, I am nothing, but with God, I can do everything. This is why Jesus came to live and die on our behalf, that he might resurrect from the grave and he might deposit into each one of us the Spirit of the living God. That we go not in the power of our own gifts and passions, but in the power of the one whose name is above every name. The one who tells us that when you're saddled with fear, when you're saddled with your failure, when you're saddled with apathy, This is a God who tells you, be strong and courageous, for I'm with you. Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. And Jesus himself has come for this very reason, to show you that you can live with a new kind of freedom, a new kind of power, a new kind of calling. Let's pray together. Father, I pray that every single one of us today, that we would not be saddled in fear or failure or apathy, but that we would live with a fire that comes from knowing that the living God, the same God who was with Moses, the same God who was with Joshua, the same God who resurrected from the grave, and in the book of Ephesians where Paul tells us that he gives us that same spirit of resurrection power, God, may we live with that kind of fire, that kind of passion, because you are God and we are not. In Jesus' name, amen.